Man, I wished I had some glasses. Wait a minute. There they are. Amazing. Video magic. Chapter 19, I'm sorry for the silliness, Harvest. You'll see on the top, that would be your nighttime. We go by Roman time, which the new day begins at midnight. So on the top, that little hash mark on the top, recognize that perhaps as midnight. And then the next day, at the bottom of the loop, recognize that as noon the next day. And so cutting right across the whole thing, let's call it an average of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. Is everybody okay? So this is maybe the best way that I know how to illustrate the last week of Jesus' life. It begins, go ahead. It begins on Palm Sunday. And he's going to show up on the blue part of that day. Jesus is crucified on the 14th day of the month of Nisan. What day is that? The Passover. A lot of people don't know that. Jesus didn't die on any day of the week or the month or the year. He died on the 14th day of the month of Nisan, when the rest of Israel was celebrating Passover. Somebody should have went, wait a minute, what day is this? He's bleeding his innocent bloodshed. This is Passover. Ding! So that's what the whole lamb sacrifice was about. Well, anyway, Jesus shows up on Palm Sunday. Everybody knows that. He stays likely with Mary and Martha on and off. And then for the next couple of days, he comes back and forth to Jerusalem to teach. And then, go ahead. Then the Last Supper is going to be on a Thursday for us. Do you see how that works? At midnight, that would have been Thursday. But he does that in front of the Passover. See where Saturday is a Sabbath? That's every Saturday. Sunday is regarded as the beginning of the new week. It's always a Saturday. But also, Passover is a Sabbath. It says so, book of Leviticus. So that night, the red portion, Jesus, of course, is back and forth in the kangaroo court. Pilate tries to get out of it, even has him scourged. How about that? Nope, we have no king but Caesar. Ooh, ouch. So then go ahead. At 9 a.m., says the Gospel of Mark, Jesus went on the cross. He's on the cross for 6 hours, says the book of Mark. The last 3 hours he's on the cross, it goes dark for 3 hours. What do you mean goes dark? I don't know that I can explain it. Was it an eclipse? No, because remember the 14th is the middle of the month, and so it's a full moon, and it cannot be eclipsed. The moon cannot be eclipsing the sun because it's in the wrong position. So what was it then? What was the darkness? The answer is, I don't know. But with your Jesus glasses on, is God light? Yes, because in him is no darkness at all. When Jesus was made to be how much sin? All sin. In model form, that is God's presence moving away from Jesus. That's why it was dark. Functionally, I don't know how God pulled it off. I'd love to see a videotape of it. In fact, I've got an interesting quote for you here in a minute. But it's dark for the last 3 hours. And Jesus says 7 crucial truths from the cross that we looked at. But you'll notice that Thursday is a Sabbath. Did you know that the 15th is also a Sabbath? Go ahead. And he, Jesus, has to be off the cross, as we'll see today in our narrative. He has to be off the cross before the Sabbath. Leviticus 23 says that Passover is a Sabbath, a holy convocation. And the very next day, the 15th, is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That too is a Sabbath. And then classic Saturday is a Sabbath as well. In this particular week in the calendar that all this is transpiring, there were 3 Sabbaths. Now, why is that important? Because most people who read the account, we have to have Jesus off the cross before the Sabbath, not being Jews, they say, oh, So we got to have him off the cross before sunset for the Saturday. And that's where a Friday or Good Friday crucifixion got its start. But as you can see, clearly mapped out on this, Jesus died on Thursday. Now, why is that important? Jesus, when they asked him, give us another sign, like he hasn't been doing that, raising the dead, casting out demons, healing the sick. And they're all, can we have another one? Jesus, oi, you know, no. A wicked generation is always after a sign. How about just be obedient to my word? But he did say, I will give you one sign. 3 days and 3 nights I will be in the bowels of the earth. Sheol, we looked at that a couple weeks ago. For 3 days and 3 nights. A Friday crucifixion wouldn't give you 3 days and 3 nights. Does everybody see? We're going to have Jesus' body off the cross by sunset, which will begin the 15th of Nisan, which Leviticus 23 says, there's your first day of unleavened bread. Oh, by the way, the Passover, was it prophetic? Yes. Was there innocent blood shed on a cross? Yes. Leaven is a model of sin. No leaven, please. Was Jesus unleavened, so to speak? Yes. Turns out the 7 feasts of Moses are prophetic. He is going to raise on guess what day? Go ahead, Chris. On the 17th. That's a Sunday. That is the feast of first fruits, Paul. Ding, I get it. Jesus is the first fruits of them that died. Jesus came out of the grave on the anniversary of when the first judgment by water was satisfied. Can you see the powerful prophecy? All right, so I wanted to show you that's very important. All right. Now with that, let's finish the last few verses in chapter 19. We're going to start with verse 31 and we'll end the chapter. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, you can write in your margin, holy convocation / Sabbath, holy convocation of unleavened bread. There on the map, that should make sense now. That the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath. Remember, there were 3 Sabbaths that week. For that Sabbath, the next one coming up in 2 hours, is going to be the 15th of the month of Nisan, or unleavened bread. And it was a high day. It was a holy convocation. It was a Sabbath. And by the way, why were they so freaked out about that? Because if you touched anything dead anytime during those couple days, oops, you are ceremonially defiled and you cannot partake in all of the family festivities and oblations. So nobody wanted that. So we better get this dead body off the cross before that. Fascinating. These Jewish leaders, we will break God's law. Dude, you killed the Messiah. Can anybody see that other than me? Can you see that? And can you see on them, gee, it looks pretty silly on those guys, that religion blinds. We'll mess up our religion if we get dead bodies on the cross for our holy day. Dude, you guys killed the Messiah. Anyway, the Jews or the Jewish leaders, they asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away. Now, this is a difficult truth, but it's a truth nonetheless. When you try it sometime, go to the park or whatever and hang on a bar and just hands over your head straight up, it's hard to breathe. Stretch them out as far as you can and then hang your full body weight on it. You will notice you cannot draw a satisfying breath. People on the cross had to push up on their nail pierced feet to relax the bellows portion of their chest to draw in a decent breath. What's with the breaking of the legs? You smash. How many of you ever hit your shin hard? Can you imagine? massive club bashing at your shins until they are shattered. Then, of course, you cannot lift your body weight, and then you suffocate. And by the way, that's what killed most people who were crucified. It's an awful, awful thing, crucifixion. It was first invented by the Persians. You can say it today, that would be your Iranian, the area of Iran. And it was meant to be the most gruesome death known to humankind. You didn't die of the superficial wounds. You died when you couldn't press up enough. Your quad muscles so exhausted and spent, you cannot lift yourself up to take a breath, and you suffocate. People on the cross sometimes lived for days. It's a gruesome, gruesome thing. Break the legs, and that'll speed suffocation. Verse 32. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first, one on Jesus' side, and then the other, who was crucified with him on his other side. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Harvest, you need to know that these aren't just happenstance, and just let's see how this thing sort of plays itself out. Can God see the future? Yes. Did God know about this? Yes. Right in your margin here, fulfilled Psalm 34, verse 20. Psalm 34, verse 20. I'll quote it. Speaking of Messiah, King David, 1,000 years before Jesus was born, he wrote, "Not one of his bones will be broken." There it is. Jesus' life, birth, life, ministry, death, and resurrection will fulfill more than 300 specific prophecies in the Old Testament. Harvest, do we see that? No other religious book, no other philosophy, no other thing written I know of has specific Bible prophecy where Jesus would be born. Bethlehem, the donkey thing we just went over, and that none of his bones would be broken. 300. Let's not miss that important fact. What you hold in your lap is history written in advance. By the way, and parenthetically, we're going to finish up the Gospel of John in probably 4 or 5 more weeks. I hope to go through 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. And then after that, we're going to be doing Bible prophecy for the next year. I think it is very important that we remind ourselves that God knew exactly what's all happening. How many of you heard that Bashar al-Assad of Syria is ousted as of this morning? He was a horrible, horrible dictator. Horrible. Propped up by the Russians, by and large. Well, he's gone now. Please pray that this next group of people will not be fanatics and that there would be some semblance of peace for the people. But stuff like that, the Arab Spring in 2011 is prophesied in the scripture. There's so much that is happening. Take a snapshot of the geopolitical climate, weird weather, the nations of Ezekiel 38 and 39, they're all in place. You need to know that it's not all falling apart. It's coming together. And God is soon to return. So I want to spend the next year on Sunday mornings. We're going to go through the book of Revelation, verse by verse. And then on Wednesday night, we're going to go through the book of Zechariah. As I've said before, pound for pound, the most prophetic book in the Bible. And then when we finish Zechariah, we're going to be probably right in line with our Sunday morning service of Revelation. We're going to be in the book of Daniel. And you're going to see, don't miss a Wednesday and don't miss a Sunday, and you're going to see that God has everything under control. Amen? Well, here's another one right here. Psalm 34, verse 20. Not one of his bones will be broken. Verse 34. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. There's so much here, Harvest, so many symbols. Blood and water in birth, as well as death. This is birthing the church, of course. And out of the first Adam's side came his bride, Eve. Out of the last Adam's side comes the church, his bride. There's so many applications, but I want to keep it for you skeptics potentially watching by video. I want you to know something that blood and water pathologists would know for certain. What is that? As a rule, we don't keep large amounts of clear liquid in our body. This means, remember, he could hardly take a breath. He's already had a significant volume of blood lost. The oxygen-carrying system of the hemoglobin is greatly restricted. And like when you get up too quick or you jump up a flight of stairs, you feel a rush of, I feel a little weird. That is your brain saying, not enough oxygen. Hey, heart, beat faster. And your heart picks up the pace to push through more red blood, which gets oxygen up to its optimal level. Remember, Jesus has lost a bunch of blood. And he slumps in death. And my suspicion, and a pathologist, I believe, would agree with me, when that Roman soldier pierces deep into Jesus' torso and notices that blood and water, a pathologist would say, when your heart is in deep crisis, the pericardial membrane around your muscle of your heart fills with pericardial fluid. And enough fluid collects, your heart now is constricted. It can't move. It will beat itself to rupture. A pathologist would say blood and water came out of that portion of his torso. Jesus died of a ruptured cardiac muscle. We might say he died of a broken heart. Hold your finger here. I want to show you something. Would you go to the book of Revelation chapter 5? Revelation chapter 5. Revelation 5. I want to show you something here. I don't know about you, but I think in simple terms, and this helps me. Chris, if you would, go to our next slide. Here's the cross. Hit the go button. And if you will, think with me, all through Jesus' wounds, how many blood stains might be on that cross? Go. Well, let's see. You got the crown of thorns, so there's the head. His back, of course, the cat of nine tails. The side, of course, would be marred by all that blood and water. Are his hands pierced? Yes. And are his feet pierced? How many wounds is that, Harvest? Six. Well, if you will, blood stains. Six. Numbers in the Bible are important. Six is the number of man. I want to show you something, though, too. Did you know that God says, I got you. Go, Chris, if you would. I got that covered for you. Because I will give you, if you're saved, a helmet of salvation, a breastplate of righteousness, a belt of truth. One hand, the sword, which is God's word. On the other hand, which is a shield. And what are your feet shod with? The preparation of the gospel. All right. I want to show you something. Are you in chapter 5, book of Revelation? Look at verse 1. By the way, if you want to see a videotape of the rapture, it's chapter 4. So John arrives, the door opens up. Come up here, a shout, and up he is. Up he comes. Chapter 4 is mostly him going, wow, wow. Watch chapter 5, verse 1. And I saw the right hand of him who sat on the throne, that's the Father, and a scroll written inside and on the back sealed with seven seals. We'll go into this in great detail. This, by the way, is when we do our book of Revelation study, but I'll give you the quick answer. This is a legal document of something that is in default. This is a legal default. It's a contract that has been disavowed. We're going to find out when we do our study. It's the contract for humankind. Verse 2, and John seemed to recognize it. Verse 2, and then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals? You see, because it's a scroll, and the reason why John knew it was a legal thing, because it had seven seals. It had one seal, you had to crack that seal, and then you would unroll the scroll to another seal, because in that opened, newly opened section are the provisos of how to take this legal default and bring it back into its proper place. Pop, 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 seven pops. So, okay, who is worthy to pop the seals? Verse 3. And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth. That is Sheol. That is the Abuso. That's where some fallen demons are held incarcerated until judgment day. So none of them either was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much. Why? Probably because John recognized, humans are in big, big trouble. No one's going to redeem this because no one was found worthy to open and to read the scroll or to look at it. Now watch this, verse 5. But one of the elders, that's the church, said to me, do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Hey, three guesses who that is. That's Jesus. The root or the offspring of King David. Is Jesus directly related to King David? Yes. Don't miss Wednesday night. We're going through the book of Ruth and we'll show you that. He has prevailed to open the scrolls and to loose the seven seals. And I looked, and there he is in the midst of the throne and on the four living creatures. And in the midst of the elders stood a lamb. Now watch closely. As though it had been what? Let me sort of rephrase that for you. In heaven and for all eternity, no man-made artifact will exist except for six wounds. What? The wounds of Jesus are going to stay on his resurrected body for all eternity. Why? I can think of a number of reasons, but think, you know, whoosh, there you are in heaven. Wow, there's the Holy Father right there. I can see him. You know, Moses said, I want to see you, Father. And God said, can't do it, Mo. Be like trying to drink from a fire hose. You'd blow away. But when you get your resurrected body, it is designed to handle the full presence, light, life, family, purpose that is heaven. I've said it before. It's almost like we're about our hair's going. Whoosh, we're looking at each other. This is awesome. In heaven, when we see the glorious presence of the Father and Jesus, like John, he will still have the wounds. And perhaps it will occur to us, the only reason I'm here in this holy, holy place is because of what he did. John Corson tells a story, I'll borrow it from him. He had a dream one night, and in the dream, he's cruising through space. You know, like John, he says, I got my flip-flops and I'm cruising through space. And suddenly I come upon heaven, and heaven is gorgeous and indescribable. His Hawaiian shirt is flapping, you know. This is awesome. And God says to John in his dream, John, I'm so glad you're here. I'm glad to be here too, Lord. Hey, John, can I ask a favor of you? Sure, Lord, anything. I need you to do something. Okay. There's a planet out there, and it's filled with doggies or dogs of all kinds. John in his dream, really? Yeah. And I need you to go to that planet of dogs and tell them about salvation. Okay. Here's the catch, John. I want you to go to this vicious planet of Doberman pincers and whatever ferocious dog breed you can think of. But I want you to go as a chihuahua. John, all right, okay. Now, when you get there, ain't nobody gonna believe you. And because they're bigger and ferocious and have terrible teeth, they're gonna rip you to shreds. John, in his dream, Well, all right. Okay, I could take one for the team. And then, John, you have to stay injured and wounded for the rest of eternity. Would you still go? John has this dream and he wakes up and he recognizes that's Revelation 5. Let's keep reading. Verse 6, and I looked and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders, there stood a lamb. But what did he look like, Harvest? When we get to heaven, I pray us from Harvest are no bumpkins, if that's the right way. Don't be surprised and don't be shocked when he says to you, you're here. And he still has the wounds. Did Thomas see the wounds on the resurrected Jesus? He sure did. Having been slain, seven horns and seven eyes, and it goes on from there. Back to Gospel of John 19. I wanted to bring that to our attention. That the only human artifacts that will live forever in eternity with the Lord are the wounds that mankind put upon our Savior. Go ahead. And he, John really speaking of himself, me the writer, and he, John, who has seen, dude, I'm an eyewitness, as testified, and his testimony is true. I saw these things, I'm not lying. And he, John, knows that he is telling the truth so that you may believe. That's why he wrote the Gospel of John, verse 36. For these things were done that the scriptures may be fulfilled, that not one of his bones shall be broken. Psalm 34, verse 20. Now verse 37. And again another scripture says, they shall look upon him, notice capital H, whom they pierced. What? Remember those 300 prophecies? Right in your margin here, Zechariah, Z-E-C-H, 12:10. Zechariah 12:10. Let me show you one of the 300. Hold your finger here. Go back. It's not that far. It's one of the last books of the Old Testament. Right before Malachi, Zechariah chapter 12, please. We're going to be going over this book on Wednesday, starting after the first of the year. Pound for pound, the most prophetic book in the Bible. Chapter 12, please, Zechariah. Let's start with verse 3. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy or burdensome stone for how many people? We are fast approaching that harvest. How many people are angry with Israel? Practically all. But there will come a time when even the United States will back away from her commitments. Woe to America the day they do. But I want to show you now verse 10, please. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. And I, Jehovah God, is speaking. I, Jehovah God, will pour on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. This is when all of Israel will be saved. You can write Romans 11, verse 26. One day the blindness in part that God allowed to settle upon the nation of Israel when they rejected him on Palm Sunday, he's going to pull that away. And they're going to go, whoa, look what we did. And they will look upon me. How many of you say capital M? That's Jehovah God. They will look upon me, Jehovah God, whom they what? Pierce, circle that. Question, when was Jehovah God pierced? When he was in a human suit on the cross of Calvary. Remember I told you 300 prophecies? Here's one of them. They will look upon me whom they pierced, and yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son. This is a grievous, terrible, oh my, of what we have done. It's more than if you had one child and lost that child to death. That's the racking sobs that Israel one day, I'll give you a hint, it's at the midpoint of the Great Tribulation. And they will grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. And in that day, verse 11, there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem. This coincides with Matthew chapter 24, when the Antichrist goes into the Holy of Holies that he got Israel built 3.5 years in front. And he says, no more worshiping any other god except me. And he puts a statue of himself in the Holy of Holies. That's when the blindness in part comes off and Israel goes, ding, you're not our Messiah. Hello? But then they begin, well, if you're not our Messiah, that blindness in part comes off. And as a nation, whoosh, Palm Sunday. Jesus is our Messiah. Got goosebumps. Ding. But then Jesus said, now when that day happens, when you see the abomination of desolation, get out of Jerusalem. Get out of there. Why? Because now the Antichrist is no more subterfuge. I'm going to kill every Jewish person I can find. And if some reason this gets into your notice and millions have disappeared, you've seen a temple in Israel go up and for 3.5 years, temple oblations, and then suddenly the man who pulled it all off then puts a statue of himself in the Holy of Holies. Get to Petra, the rock city of Petra, in today what is Jordan. That is the only place you will be safe. Get there by any means. Anyway, but for us, and in that day, midpoint of the Great Tribulation, great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Ramon in the plain of Megiddo. That's 2 Chronicles 35. That's when beloved King Josiah is killed. Verse 12, and the land shall mourn every family by itself, the family of the house of David. Read that, kings. Families of the house of Nathan. Read that, prophets. Verse 13, the family of the house of Levi. Read that, priests. Because for the last 3.5 years, there have been temple oblations in the third temple that Antichrist got built there in Jerusalem. They're going to see it too. Family of Shimei, if you know that story, the detractors that he's not really Messiah. Ding, yes, he is. They're going to mourn. Verse 14, and all circle all Romans 11:26. How many of Israel will be saved one day? Answer, say with me, all of them. Because God hates the Jews and he's done with the Jews. No, he's not. The nation of Israel, the Jewish people, have a significant portion to play in the book of Revelation. Verse 14, all the families that remain, every family by itself and their wives by themselves. And they're going to get saved. All right, back to John, and we're going to probably hurry up and finish to the end. Back to the Gospel of John, now in verse 38. Now after this, Jesus is dead. Take his body off the cross. You got 2 hours before sunset. Today is the 14th, which is the Passover. What day is it now when sunset happens? The 15th, or the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, a Sabbath. So we have to have him off the cross. After this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews. Remember, if the Pharisees and Sadducees didn't like you, they could have you shunned. And we don't know how Joseph of Arimathea acquired his wealth, but I'll bet a big portion of it was probably marketing his product, whatever that might have been. He'll get his business shut down. That's why he was following Jesus in secret. He asked Pontius Pilate that he may take the body away, the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave his permission. So he came and he took the body of Jesus, and Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, that was in chapter 3, he also was being secretive. And by the way, in the Gospel of John and all the Gospels, how do we know what was going on and what was being said there in the synagogue, and especially the Sanhedrin? Because Nicodemus was there, and he later told John and Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Watch this. He came, Nicodemus, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, Myrrh is a gummy substance that is squished from a myrrh tree. And then what are aloes? Those are wood products that you get, you pulverize them into powder, and then you mix the powder, which is sweet-smelling aloes, with the sticky gummy myrrh, add a little water, and it became a kind of a gluish or paste-type consistency. Because here's what they would do. They would take strips of cloth, and they would sew the ends together, making one long strip, and they would dunk it in the paste of the myrrh and the aloes, moistening. They would start at the toes and wrap the body up to the armpits, fold the arms down, start at the middle finger, wrap again. It's not just loose strips of cloth. They have been dunked and saturated with 100 pounds of this gluish paste type consistency. Then from the middle finger, wrap again to the neck, and then over, they wrap to the neck. This is important because your shoulders are covered, and then cover the face with a cloth. That's how they did it. In about 3 days, all of that once moistened and sticky, pasted together strips of cloth would dry. What's another way of saying dry? It hardened. This is one of the important miracles of Resurrection Sunday that is lost on many. We're going to see that John sticks his head in and he sees the grave clothes to us. What is that, like a long cloth? No, it was a kind of a mummy. And the mummy wrap was intact in the form of a body. How did Jesus get out of that? A cast, a cocoon. Jesus didn't thrash his way out. That would have left quite a mess. And frankly, in his state of, if he were still human and he was depleted of blood and strength, he could not have thrashed out of them in the first place. But even if he was, if he suddenly was Arnold Schwarzenegger, there would be shrapnel laying all around. When John looks in, he sees the cocoon. He takes his cell phone and he hits the flashlight and he looks right down the middle of it. Hello, hello, hello. Nothing was inside. Jesus didn't unwrap himself. He resurrected right through them. Sorry for the shout, but that's very exciting to me. Look at this, and if you haven't circled it, you should. Verse 39, Nicodemus, who at first came to Jesus by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes. Now you know what that is. How much, you guys? 100 pounds. How many of you wrestle with a 40-pound bag of dog food? Put two of those on your body. Now stand up. That's a lot of weight. It's a cocoon, verse 40. Then they took the body of Jesus and bound it in strips of linen with spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury, as I've explained. Verse 41. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had been laid. Probably Joseph's own tomb. He was a rich guy because that was not a small investment to hack out of a sheer face a compartment to lay in. And then, of course, then they would roll a stone in front of that, and then a big stone, so the grave robbers couldn't get at it. Verse 42. So there they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day. And that's why a lot of people say, oh, you mean the Sabbath. So Sabbath is Saturday, so the crucifixion took place on Friday. No. This preparation day, right, 15th, a.k.a. unleavened bread, for the tomb was nearby. And I want to quote John Corson here, and he says, this request would have ruined Joseph's business and jeopardized Nicodemus's respect and religious standing. It seems to me, says John Corson, the way to motivate people to serve Christ is not make them feel guilty, not put pressure on them, not to try to manipulate their emotions, but simply to allow them, like Nicodemus and Joseph, to see what Jesus did for them stuff, and I want to show you some brain stuff now. How many are open for a little brain stuff? Good, if you would, Chris. I want to show you that Jesus is an actual person of history. And I'm going to show you seven powerful reasons to believe your Bible. Seven proofs of the resurrection that must be considered by any honest skeptic. Thing we better get to first. So was Jesus a real person of history? Yes, he was. Go. Who is this? This is my uncle. This is Uncle Flavius Josephus, born AD 32, so a few years after the events we've been reading. And he wrote some books. He was employed by the Romans. He was a Jewish fellow. Gets captured in a battle. He's offered a choice. Hey, you can write. You're a man of letters. I'll tell you what. Here's your choice. Work for the Romans, documenting... what's his name? Come on, brain. The Roman honcho cruising through the region of the time. Titus, there we go, Vespasian. You work for Mr. Vespasian and document his glorious victories over your Jewish people, or you die. He's all, I'll work for you. And he wrote down much of what happened, which culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's who Flavius Josephus is. And he wrote about it. He is one of the most noted historians of the day. He said this: at this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. Everybody see it there? Pilate condemned him to be crucified and die. And his disciples reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Was Jesus a factual person of history? Go. Here's my other uncle. This is my uncle Cornelius Tacitus. He is a Roman historian and a bit of a Mark Twain, as it were, a skilled satirist. That's his statue outside of the Austrian Parliament. They really like that guy. But anyway, he's lived between 53 and 120 AD, so he's within one generation of the events there in Israel. He was a Roman historian and politician. He was also a governor of Asia. He wrote some stuff too. He said, quote, he, meaning Nero, falsely charged the guilt and punished Christians. Christus, that's Jesus, the founder of the same, was put to death by Pontius Pilate. But the pernicious superstition, that's the resurrection, repressed for a time, broke out against not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. Yes, there's a Jesus. And yes, there are people claiming to be eyewitnesses to his resurrection. Here's my other uncle, go. Uncle Lucian of Samosata. Samosata, a fancy word for Turkey. He was modern day Turkey, not Thanksgiving Turkey. That's where Steve's brain is. He was born 125 AD, so was still within one generation of the events. He was from Assyria. He, too, was a doubter. In fact, he was a satirist. He wrote spitefully against the Christians in his work, one of his works, The Passing Peregrinus. Quote, a man who was crucified in Palestine, Jesus, because he introduced this new cult into the world. There's another mention of Jesus as a person of history. Go. Now we're going to see something called the letter of Mara Bar Serapion. Bar meaning son of. So who was this guy? This is a Syrian dude, and this correspondence was from 73 AD, within the time of these events. Serapion was his son, Mara Bar Serapion, in prison. Quote, what advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king, Jesus? It was just after that their kingdom was abolished. Yeah, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, 70 AD. Suetonius Tranquillus, love these names, AD 120, a Roman historian, court official under Emperor Hadrian. He wrote a thing or two as well. Life of Claudius, book 25, verse 4. As the Jews were making constant disturbance at the instigation of Christus, it's another way of saying Christus, everyone, Jesus, he, Emperor Hadrian, expelled him from Rome. This is another mention that a man named Jesus is a man of history. I hit the go button. Tertullian, many of you may recognize that name. He was a pretty famous writer and a jurist of Carthage in North Africa. He wrote around 197 AD, but the Jews were so exasperated by Christus, who is that? Jesus, his teaching, that at last they brought him before Pontius Pilate, at the time the Roman governor of Syria. And they, by violence against him, extorted, interesting he had that understanding, a sentence of crucifixion. Is Jesus a factual figure of actual history? Yes, I got Plinius Secundus, also known as Pliny the Younger, because he used face cream and he never went outside without sunblock, that's why. He was governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor. And in AD 112, he wrote in the letter to Emperor Trajan how to deal with these wacky Christians. Should he continue to kill them as he discovers them, or only certain ones? Hey, Emperor, these Christians, they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light. That would be Sunday. That's where the tradition of meeting on Sunday comes from, on Resurrection Day. There they would sing to Christus. Who is Christus? Another name, please. Jesus, as God, and bound themselves to some kind of solemn oath, like their reference to communion, that they not deny this trust when they should be called upon to deliver it up. In other words, these guys are dying for this man he knew as Christus. That's Jesus. Go. Thallus of Samaria, he's an historian, a region near Jerusalem. He wrote in 52 AD. He was trying to deal, now listen to this. He was trying to figure out the inexplicable darkness that fell over the region for 3 hours. Did you see it? What did you see? Now watch this. It's not an ellipse because there was a full moon. The moon has to be in the phase in front of the sun. So it couldn't have been an eclipse. A solar eclipse could not possibly take place in that full moon. Passover is at a full moon. It's on the 14th in the middle of the month. Was the Paschal or the Passover full moon? We can't figure it out. What was that darkness about? Did you pay the power bill? And then we get to Phlegon of Tralles, Rome, first century historian, in his book, 711b, section 256, page 1165. During the time of Tiberius Caesar, an eclipse of the sun occurred during the full moon. Can the moon eclipse the sun when the moon is directly 180 degrees out of phase? No, he couldn't figure it out either. And by the way, the Quran, codified about 700 AD, refers to Jesus 187 times and often as Isa ben Miriam or Jesus, the son of Mary. The Pharisees were the conservatives of the Jews. The Sadducees were the liberals or the intellectual elite. The Herodians were the politically connected. And of course, the Romans were not even Jewish, and they couldn't care less about what these Jews. And throughout the Gospels, and even in the book of Acts, did you notice? These powerful factions were always warring against each other. Yet, they were all united against Jesus and the apostles. And then in Acts chapter 2, when Peter is standing in that large crowd. Hey! The same crowd largely that 50 days in front were yelling, crucify him. John's going, don't say it, Peter. Peter, and this Messiah was Jesus, and you killed him on a cross. But he rose. Question. Why did the Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, and Romans say, nah, he's still in the tomb? Nobody spoke against Peter in Acts 2 about the resurrection. to this packed crowds of Jerusalem Pentecost. And 3,000 of this crowd receives and accepts Jesus as their Lord. Why? Here we go. Go, if you would. Because there's an empty tomb, you guys. Here's a beautiful picture, what's called the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem. Is that the actual tomb of Jesus? Could be. Likely not. The best historians say, nope. There are other markings on it. That probably doesn't show up until the second or third century. I don't really care. Was there one time an empty tomb? And it likely stood in the region until the Ottoman Turks destroyed it, likely for several centuries. But this garden tomb is beautiful. If you've been to Israel, it's a wonderful, beautiful place. It was discovered by a British archaeologist, and he said, I wonder if this could be. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is 1,000 feet to the south. For a long time, they thought that was the tomb. Likely not either. I don't care what it is, but was there at one time a stone rolled back from an empty tomb? Yes. With that, go. I think there are 7 inescapable facts. Number one, go ahead. Hundreds of eyewitnesses. And remember, Matthew, Mark, and Luke Gospels were being copied and distributed among the world while people who were eyewitnesses were still alive. Somebody could have taken a book of Mark to Jerusalem and say, what about this resurrection? And you could have run into someone who said, I saw the resurrected Jesus at Walmart, whatever it might be. Number two, an empty tomb. All you have to do to put a pin in Christianity is give me the dead body. None was ever produced. Why? Because that dead body got up and walked out of there. And then it rose from the Mount of Olives. Number three, you have to explain to me a large stone moved uphill. Yeah, you need to know something, that many manuscripts or copies of Matthew, Mark, Luke, etc. exist. Fragments exist that date within the lifetime of the people who wrote them. There's no actual autographs, the actual letter of Mark, the actual letter of Matthew, but we have scraps and pieces of ones that date within the lifestyle before they died. One of them is called the Bizet Manuscript. It's now at Cambridge University. It dates to within 75 years of the original. That's how old it is. And it's been in Cambridge University since the 1400s. And in the Bizet Manuscript, in the section of Mark chapter 16, verse 4, it tells us about that stone that was very large. A scribe noted in the margin. How many of you love to write in your margin? 2,000 years from now, someone may dig up your Bible. So go ahead, go ahead. So written in the margin, a scribe wrote, quote, 20 men couldn't budge it. It was big. It was huge. You have to explain to me. The disciples came and they stole the bodies. 11 at that point, skinny teenagers, are going to fend off a Roman guard, clang, 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 and the rest of you go roll a 2-ton stone out of the doorway? Say with me, I don't think so. You have to explain that. The Bible says an angel rolled it back and then he sat on it. Read that, large angel. The Roman guard, go. Who is this guy? This guy's name is go. There he is. That is Flavius Vigitius Renatus. Good name. He was a Roman military historian, and he wrote a book called Concerning Military Matters, and there's a copy of one from 1494. But his first edition was 350 AD. Rome was at the height of its power. Why are they so good with these Roman soldiers? And he told us all about what happens in a Roman battalion. And when he says a Roman guard, he says that's easy. That's 6 to 14 dudes. They sleep in shifts. They were trained to fight to the death to protect six feet square around them. They could fight shoulder to shoulder. They could fight back to back. But two Roman soldiers alone could defend a 6-foot circumference to the death because they were trained and equipped. There were 4 to 16 of those guys around the tomb of Jesus. Why? Because the Pharisee says, you know, the disciples are going to come steal the body, and then the second deception will be worse than the first. I don't want any of that, says Pilate. Take a guard. So a Roman guard was positioned around the tomb. Why did they desert? Mr. Renatus says that if you deserted your post, you would be killed. Here's another thing that Mr. Renatus told us. Maybe they fell asleep. He said that if your captain came along and found you sleeping, he could light your uniform on fire. Was there a great reason to stay awake at your post? Why did they all desert? Bible tells us they deserted because of a big angel freaked them out. And they ran to the Pharisees and said, we're in deep trouble. We have deserted our post, and now we're going to get killed. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees said, we'll protect you. You just tell them that the disciples scared off 4 to 16 trained guerrillas, and we'll call it cool. Nope. Number 5, go. The grave clothes. It was a hardened cocoon harvest. It was still intact. One of the miracles of Resurrection Sunday was a cocoon in the shape of a body. Number 6, go. Every disciple died for their claim that Jesus rose from the dead. How many of the disciples of the 11, including the Apostle Paul, were tortured for their faith? All of them. Fox's Book of Martyrs, check it out. Not one of them said, okay. We were fibbing. All of them, under penalty of torture and death, said, yes, it happened, and he rose from the dead. And finally, number 7, there was a hostile witness that was converted. Who was that? That's the Apostle Paul. He was killing Christians. He was another eyewitness. Why and how would you explain the sudden turnaround of the Apostle Paul? Because he said, I saw the resurrected Jesus. Go. Let's all stand together. I want you to get a good picture of that. In fact, Chris, would you bring the house lights down a little bit? Harvest, look at that cave. That might not be the actual one, but think with me. There was one. Hundreds of eyewitnesses. Can you look up and see that empty tomb? Do you recognize and do you realize that your faith in Jesus Christ is not some sort of leap of faith? It is based on the historical foundation that a guy once lived, was killed brutally and publicly, and 3 days later, hundreds of people swore they saw him walking around. And many more said they watched him elevate from the Mount of Olives right out of sight. There is an empty tomb, and no other philosophy or religion is based on that kind of archaeologically substantiated fact.